I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, in this week for Tanzina Vega. Good to have you with us.
Old time Big Ten football. Touchdown, Purdue!
Well, he said, I got to grab it, and he threw out one of the quickest guys in college baseball.
Gets the Pios on the board first. That's the first goal UMass has allowed in the NCAA tournament this year.
College athletics is characterized by many inequalities that are, well, just... Number one, in many of the nation's poorest states, the highest paid public official is the college football coach. South Carolina, Kentucky, and Alabama have some of the highest poverty rates in the nation, and they each have a state university football coach who earned $9 million in 2020.
Ew.
Two, the equipment, resources, and opportunities that colleges supply for their women athletes are routinely inferior to what they supply for men.
Ew.
And finally, number three, the NCAA makes more than $1 billion a year from the labor of college athletes. But those athletes cannot so much as accept gas money from a team booster without fear of committing a career-ending violation.
Damn!
On Monday, the Supreme Court handed down a decision which chips away at this last ew. The Supreme Court unanimously ruled in NCAA versus Alston that the NCAA was violating federal antitrust laws by restricting the education-related benefits that universities and colleges could provide to athletes. And as for the NCAA's claim that limiting compensation was necessary to preserve amateurism in collegiate sports, well, in his concurring opinion, Justice Brett Kavanaugh said, get that on out of here, when he wrote, quote, traditions alone cannot justify the NCAA's decision to build a massive money-raising enterprise on the backs of student athletes who are not fairly compensated. Nowhere else in America can businesses get away with agreeing not to pay their workers a fair market rate on the theory that their product is defined by not paying their workers a fair market rate. Justice Kavanaugh's argument is reminiscent of a similar conclusion made by historian Taylor Branch in his now classic 2011 piece, The Shame of College Sports. Branch wrote, quote, in the era when our college sports first arose, colonial powers were turning the whole world upside down to define their own interests as all-inclusive and benevolent. Just so, the NCAA calls it heinous exploitation to pay college athletes a fair portion of what they earn. So let me just note this for the NCAA. When your actions can be denounced with equal disdain by a justice who is using free market ideals and by a civil rights historian who is drawing on post-colonial discourse, that's strong evidence that you are indeed ew. Here to help us figure out what all this means for the future of college sports is Amira Rose Davis, Assistant Professor of History and African American Studies at Penn State. She's also co-host of Burn It All Down. Amira, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Yeah, happy to be here.
And also joining me is Adam Liptak, who covers the United States Supreme Court for The New York Times. Adam, welcome to The Takeaway.
Good to be here, Melissa.
So, Adam, can you walk us through the Supreme Court ruling a bit earlier this week and tell us sort of where this came from and what is relevant about this decision?
So this is an antitrust case. And if you think about it, it's a classic antitrust case because the NCAA has a monopoly over the labor of college athletes. And it uses that monopoly power to pay them essentially nothing. A bunch of athletes challenged that in a class action. And a judge in California said, that's right. And I'm going to issue a narrow ruling that at least as to education related benefits, you know, musical instruments, scientific instruments, summer study abroad, graduate tuition, things that are tied and tethered to education, the NCAA cannot tell its member colleges and universities that they can't compete for athletes' labor on that ground. And the Supreme Court upheld that. Now, so that's fairly narrow. The payments we're talking about are education related. But the logic of the decision, and especially a concurring opinion from Justice Brett Kavanaugh, really suggests that the door is open to further challenges that might allow actual direct salary-like payments to these college athletes, some of whom are huge stars, and yet they get nothing from, as you noted, the billions that these sports programs make.
Indeed, Kavanaugh was pretty explicit that he understood this as a decision meant to eventually sort of topple the way the NCAA constrains what players can earn, for, which, as you've pointed out, is essentially nothing at this point for their college athletics.
Yeah, he comes out swinging. Brett Kavanaugh is a huge sports fan, And he has thought about this deeply, cares about it deeply. And he just doesn't understand why this business, unlike other businesses, he said, what if all the restaurants got together and said, we're not going to pay our workers because they should do it for the love of food? Or what if all law firms got together and said, we're not going to pay law firm associates because they should do the work for the love of the law? This same kind of thinking, he says, takes place when the NCAA says, well, amateurism is such a great value that it should allow us not to pay the players. So he was having none of it.
Although, just at this moment, it occurs to me there's probably some waitresses like, I do think maybe the $2.15 tip minimum feels like nothing, but we'll do that on another segment. Amira, let's talk a little bit about how athletes themselves are experiencing this decision. I was just looking at the NCAA website and seeing that the NCAA defines itself as a member-led organization dedicated to the well-being and lifelong success of college athletes. And not to, you know, mock that, but I'm wondering if college athletes feel that way about NCAA.
Well, no, we can mock that. When they say they're a member-led institution and they're looking out for people, what they're looking out for is the universities and the college presidents and athletic departments, not the athletes, right? They're going to use the rhetoric of care and protection to over-regulate, to over-restrict, right? And one of the things that this is addressing is those restrictions that are tighter on college athletes than many other students. But the athletes themselves, I mean, first of all, the evidence is in the fact that they brought this case. And I think it's important to remember that, you know, back in 2014, you have both representation with Alston from football, but you also have Justine Hartman, who was a center at Berkeley, who represents Division I basketball, both men's and women's basketball. So you have a lot of energy behind these cases. And then you also have professional players associations of the NBA, the NFL, the WNBA, who also, you know, been applauding this the whole way through. And so it isn't surprising to me that a lot of athletes are seeing this as a net positive, are seeing this as another thing that's kind of chipping away at this kind of situations system as we know it, that they feel is deeply exploitative, and, you know, with good reason. And I think that this feels like a breath. It's not the whole thing. It's not a full exhale, because the NCAA, if nothing else, knows how to reassert itself, knows how to maintain power, knows how to drag its feet to try to figure out how to do that. But I think that, you know, this is a huge indication, right, that going forward, amateurism is up for debate, and that people are not really abiding by these romantic arguments that try to use that as a shield for exploitative labor conditions.
So dig in a little bit for when I say college athletes. I think so many of us immediately go to football, basketball, maybe lacrosse and baseball, like if we've got a kind of expansive notion. But is this going to make any difference, for example, for women's basketball players or field hockey players, for gymnasts or for, you know, the crew team? Where will this matter? Or is this really just a football basketball question?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think this is a really important thing to kind of parse out. So like I said, women's basketball is including in this. They are not disaggregated from the collective Division I basketball players who brought this. And I think that we get into this situation where we want to say, oh, the Olympic sports or the non-revenue sports, we usually use women's sports or Title IX as the kind of distraction within that. But you've seen from college athletes themselves who are saying, no, like actually, whether we're talking about educational benefits or, of course, name, image, and likeness, which is moving, is a process going on as well, like we stand to benefit from this as well. And those same over-restrictions that happen on college football players happen on other college athletes. And I think that we gravitate to that, of course, because of the massive disparity in revenue. And really, football is its own behemoth. Like, we put basketball in there because of March Madness, but football, I mean, I think they're generating way, 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 way more, multiple millions of dollars more than basketball. So they're really in their own category. And then from there, the same over-restrictions, especially on ed benefits in terms of student athletes who are not able to take paid internships, who might need food, who might need a laptop. These restrictions affect swimmers who might come from impoverished backgrounds and need that as well. And so I think that the more you get the NCAA off of their backs and off of regulation, the better it is for everyone.
Adam, I want to come to you a second on this, because I was so happy to hear you say that what's going on with Kavanaugh in part here is that this is something he's thought about for a long time as someone who cares a lot about sport. Because I have to say, I've been just a little bit surprised that we've seen as many unanimous decisions from the court as we have this time. And I'm wondering, should I not be surprised? Did I just get kind of sucked in by the cable news anxiety of it all? But at some point, I kind of thought, oh no, we're never going to have another unanimous court decision because the justices are so divided.
People misunderstand that, and partly the press, by which I mean, you know, me, is to blame. We do focus on the big 5-4, 6-3 decisions that come out at the end of the term. But for much of the term, the court does try to find consensus. It's unanimous 30% of the time. And this case doesn't really have a political tilt, right? Whether you look at it as a matter of fundamental fairness or whether you look at it as a matter of antitrust law, the justices did not have a hard time at all finding that this is intolerable. So I don't want to undersell the idea that the court is and will be closely divided on politically controversial cases. But it just didn't think this was one of them. And just to repeat myself, 9-0 decisions are not that unusual. About a third of the court's decisions are 9-0, but they tend to be in less significant cases than this one.
So, Mira, I want to go back to that Taylor Branch piece from a decade ago for a moment. He wrote in it, slavery analogies should be used carefully. College athletes are not slaves. Yet, to survey the scene, corporations and universities enriching themselves on the back of uncompensated young men whose status as student athletes deprives them of the right to due process guaranteed by the Constitution is to catch an unmistakable whiff of the plantation, unquote. So I'm wondering the ways in which race may be playing into both the resistance to compensating athletes and also to athletes' own understanding of their experience in college athletics.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it would be quite frankly irresponsible to ignore race and the way it's working here. Taylor Branch, I think, quite convincingly argues that one of the reasons it's so hard to move the needle on this is that, you know, people just aren't really caring about the exploitation of Black athletes and this kind of prevailing idea that they're there to entertain. They don't really have labor rights. Why are they complaining? They should be grateful to be in college in the first place, is so prevalent that it has been very hard until really recently to drum up widespread public support, let alone legal support at that. And I think that you see this play out in a number of ways. Here on my campus, Penn State, of course, demographically, Black students make up a very small amount of the student body, but certainly overrepresented on the football team. And so what does it look like to have that team be the cash cow for the athletic department, but also what we've seen in this last year especially? I mean, I think the pandemic has really laid a lot of this bare in ways that we can absolutely not deny. When you're sending students home but keeping the football team, when Oklahoma State coach Mike Gundy is saying these kids are going to be all right if they get COVID, but they need to start playing again to run money through the state. When those things are happening and you're seeing that disparity in terms of who is being asked to risk their health to play, and especially at schools in the Big Ten, where the rest of the student body, the rest of the athletic department even, is not Black, It's really undeniable. And I think that it leads into a perception that athletes, I know at least the college athletes I talk to and work with, have of themselves, that they receive messages that they are only there to play football, that their education is being shortchanged, that the assumption is that that's what they're there for. And so Black students who are not athletes have that same perception on them. So even non-athletes are being asked, what sport do you play? The presumption being the only reason you're at this predominantly white school in the middle of Pennsylvania is if you're contributing, if you're playing a sport and you're making money for the university. And I think that is very, that's a burden to carry that they articulate and talk about a lot.
So, Adam, Professor Davis brings us to this point that, for example, state universities in particular are not only sort of member institutions of the NCAA, they're also institutions of the state themselves. And we know that some states are taking action to circumvent the NCAA's ability to limit how athletes are earning money or getting these, sort of educational contributions. But I'm wondering if the state having those decisions is really any better for the student athletes than the NCAA.
So you raise an important point. There are colleges that are private institutions, which maybe should have more leeway. But if the state is in essence discriminating, that is a constitutional violation. There's also a separate kind of state action being taken in state legislatures, six or seven of them, circumvent the NCAA's power by giving rights directly to student athletes to exploit their names, images, and likenesses to allow them to make money off of their fame. And, some of these athletes are celebrities. And those laws will allow potentially large amounts of money to flow to student athletes. And there's nothing the NCAA can do about that.
So, Amira, let me ask this. Given what we know about, especially for some athletes, football is a really great example. And there's parts of the year, I think, where this is also true for both men's and women's basketball teams. We know that student athlete label may not be quite right. The expectation is putting, first the team. Should colleges be hosting athletics at this level, full stop? Should young people who want to do this kind of athletics, should they be just able to do it and then maybe get a sort of a GI Bill level college scholarship they could then use later? I mean, is the expectation of both being a student and being an athlete at, sort of a professional level reasonable?
Yeah, I mean, like, not as it currently stands, right? I mean, student athlete, that's a term that was legally used to just try to prevent workers' compensation claims. The entire system that we have now really is not only being challenged left and right and all over the place, but it's outdated. It hasn't accounted for the massive boom in the amount of revenue that's coming in. One of my favorite arguments the NCAA tried to make is like, oh, this will contribute to an arms race, as if football programs are not already building spas, right, to pad their budgets. And so I definitely think that there's an opportunity here that actually invites us to actually rethink the college structure in general. The NCAA has been very reluctant to do that. As you mentioned, there's six states that are about to pass name, image, and likeness laws that are going to go into effect July 1. And the NCAA has had time to evolve and try to, do anything with this. And they just are so determined to cling to the remnants of a system that has benefited them so much. And I do think that that question is a hard one, but it's one to wrestle with. If this is the farm system for professional leagues, if this has been the only option, we've seen certain people step outside of that and challenge this kind of pipeline. But what does it look like to actually rethink the purpose of college athletics? Now, for some people, it really works. And I don't discount that at all. I have many college athletes who say, this worked for me in terms of my education. I taught a 9 a.m. class that was 85% college athletes, all of them coming in from morning lifts, and they were exhausted. That is not prioritizing education, which is why the arguments that the NCAA makes about them getting this education as compensation feel so ridiculous. And everybody knows it.
And because I teach at 3, I never get college athletes. Adam Liptak covers the United States Supreme Court for the New York Times, and Amira Rose Davis is an assistant professor of history and African American studies at Penn State. She's also co-host of the Burn It All Down podcast. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Over the weekend, a winner was declared in Iran's presidential elections. Hardline candidate Ebrahim Raisi secured victory, although less than 50% of Iranians participated in the vote. Now, according to organizations including Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch, Raisi oversaw the executions of around 5,000 dissidents in the 1980s, and the U.S. has current sanctions against Raisi for alleged human rights abuses. The new leader will take office in roughly 6 weeks. His ascension will mark a turn from the current, more moderate presidential administration of Hassan Rouhani. On Monday, White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki was asked about the upcoming leadership change.
And on Iran, the newly elected president has indicated that he does not wish to meet with President Biden or to engage on the components of the JCPOA. What is the president's view on that?
Well, we don't currently have diplomatic relations with Iran or any plans to meet with the lead at the leader level, so it's unclear that anything has actually changed on that front. I will say that the president's view and our view is that the decision maker here is the supreme leader. That was the case before the election, is the case today, will be the case probably moving forward.
So while the time frame to renegotiate the terms of the 2015 deal is brief, officials on both sides appear optimistic that a deal can be reached before Iran's presidential transition. And for more, I'm joined now by Farnaz Fasihi, a reporter who writes about Iran for The New York Times. Farnaz, it is great to have you back on the show.
Thank you very much for having me, Melissa.
So we mentioned that turnout was relatively low for this election. Can you talk to us a little bit about why that might be the case?
This was an unprecedentedly low turnout for Iran. Usually during presidential elections, there's at least 50% or more than 50% participation. People really mobilize and campaign and engage with the election. But this time around, there seemed to be a widespread dissatisfaction with the status quo. A lot of Iranians say that over and over, they come and vote and endorse a candidate and put their hopes and dreams into a person that promises during the campaign that he will bring some change, open up Iran a bit socially, engage with the world and improve the economy. And administration after administration comes into office and fails to deliver those promises. Not only fails to deliver promises, but things are demonstrably getting worse for Iranians. So I think that Iranians wanted to send a message. They've been saying in their protests in the streets that they are done with both the reformist camp and the conservative camp. And this time around, they acted on those words. And out of about 59 eligible voters, only 30 million people did not vote.
It's almost like an American election in the sense of those low turnout. When I was first looking at the numbers, I thought, is that low? And until I went back and understood that typically those turnout numbers are closer to the 70%. And right. So that is quite low.
They're saying it was below 50%. All the polls beforehand show that there was at least 43% participation. And the other remarkable thing is that Ebrahim Raisi won the votes for about 17 million, but second place came to invalid ballots. So a lot of Iranians that felt like they had to participate in the election because maybe they're government employees or they're university students, because when you vote in Iran, your official ID, it gets stamped. So if you're applying for an official job or even applying for university, they will look to see if you're elected and it might weigh on that. So some people who may have taken that into consideration went to the ballot boxes and put either empty ballots in the box or they wrote something else down. So we have Ebrahim Raisi, then second place, 4 million invalid votes, and then the other candidates. So, you know, there was really this grassroots movement from inside Iran. This they said, okay, well, this time around, we're going to sit it out and see if you finally understand that we are unhappy with the way things are.
So let me ask simply this. What do Americans need to know about this new incoming president?
Well, I think that the most important thing to note is that this completes a takeover of the conservative faction of all branches of government, that Iran really, with this election, moved to consolidate power. This election is largely being seen by Iranians and by Iran watchers as sort of engineered to make sure that Mr. Raisi wins, because there was a lot of vetting of all the candidates that would pose a real competition to him, right? So the people that he ran against were people that the public didn't know. They really had no track record of governance, kind of ensuring that to the extent that there were votes, it would be for him. So there's he's coming in with this cloud of this election not really being an election, sort of being engineered over his head, but he's also facing very serious allegations of human rights abuses that have been documented over the years by Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, and other human rights organizations. He's, as you mentioned, designated on the U.S. sanctions list for human rights violation, and he has said that his views are very revolutionary. Yesterday in his press conference, he said the priority for his administration was to be revolutionary and anti-corruption, and that he would not be willing to meet President Joe Biden. So we're definitely seeing a hardening of positions and policies by Iran as the conservatives move to now take over the government as well.
And yet, despite that consolidating of the hard line of the conservatism, this moment, these next 6 weeks before he takes office, might actually represent an opening for the United States relative to the Iran nuclear deal. Is that correct?
That's correct, Melissa. And the reason is sanctions have really hurt the economy and people's livelihoods have shrunk, both because of sanctions and because of mismanagement and corruption. That also leads into it. Iran's currency has plunged some 80% since the sanctions have started. So Mr. Raisi knows that the population is restive, that he's ruling over, the conservatives are going to be ruling over a majority that is not conservative. So fixing the economy is a number one priority for them. And really the only way they can do this is by lifting sanctions. So their goal is to move in the direction that the sanctions are removed. And this presents a good window for that to happen because, you know, if the nuclear deal is retrieved and the U.S. returns and Iran returns to its commitment and sanctions are lifted, his administration's, the conservatives, will reap the benefits. Mr. Raisi will take office in August. If sanctions are lifted, Iran can once again sell its oil. It can have access to billions of dollars of frozen funds. So that gives him an immediate boost. Now, if there's a deal that's reached and the Americans don't follow through with some of the promises and it falters again, then the conservatives can come back and blame the current government and say, well, you renegotiated, you returned. So it gives them this kind of opportunity to play one or the other. And from what we're hearing from sources, the final draft of the deal has been written, that it has Ayatollah Khamenei, Iran's supreme leader, who does have the final word on all key state matters. He wants a deal. He wants sanctions to be lifted.
So we've been talking a little bit here about the U.S. foreign policy question. What about other players in the region? We've already heard some tough language coming out of Israel. What does this election mean for the region?
I think for the region, we should expect that Iran's policies will remain intact, that they're not going to really withdraw supporting the militias that are in the region, the proxy militias that they fund and they arm from Iraq to Syria to Yemen. So we're going to see an Iran that will be present in the region in a much more serious way. And as you pointed out, that will continue to be a concern for Israel.
Farnaz Fasihi is a reporter who writes about Iran for the New York Times. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me, Melissa.
They shoot journalists on sight in the Capitol. They literally see us as enemy combatants.
In the new movie Civil War, the United States is up in flames, and the truth teller is just another casualty.
The movie is using journalism as a lens to show you what happens when social trust breaks down completely.
On this week's On the Media from WNYC. Find On the Media wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, in for Tanzina Vega. And yes,
it's the most wonderful time of the year.
It's the season we've been breathlessly anticipating.
Today is Amazon Prime Day.
These are the top 50 Amazon Prime Day deals 2021.
Welcome to Amazon Prime Day.
It is that time of the year again, one of my personal favorites, Amazon Prime Day.
Amazon Prime Day, the season of discounted joy and free fast delivery. It's all very exciting, unless of course you work in an Amazon warehouse. Now from that vantage, Prime Day feels a little bit more like the classic 1952 Chocolate Factory episode of I Love Lucy.
All right, girls, now this is your last chance. If one piece of candy gets past you and into the packing room unwrapped, you're fired.
Yes, ma'am.
Let her roll!
Now, you know what happens next. As the speed of the conveyor belt increases, Lucy and Ethel struggle to keep up, and they end up shoveling handfuls of chocolates into their pockets and their shirts and their mouths as the studio audience roars with laughter. But it's a reality that is anything but funny for the Amazon workers who are living with the consequences of an Amazon-imposed conveyor belt acceleration. For these Amazon warehouse workers and delivery drivers, Prime Day means more exhaustion, injuries, unsafe working conditions, invasive corporate monitoring, and fear of retaliation. On Monday, a coalition of racial and labor justice organizations published a letter to Amazon calling for federal agencies to investigate employee allegations of abusive and unsafe workplace practices. During a year of quarantine, millions of us counted on Amazon to deliver the electronic devices that kept us connected, the clothes that kept us Zoom ready, and the groceries that kept us fed. Amazon was our lifeline in a time of death. So, finding fair labor solutions to the Amazon juggernaut won't be as easy as swallowing a handful of chocolates. With us now is Lauren Corey Gurley, who is Senior Staff Writer at Motherboard, Vice's tech site. Lauren, it's great to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me, Melissa.
And I'm also joined by Annie Palmer, CNBC tech reporter. Thank you also for being here, Annie.
Thanks so much for having me.
All right, Annie, I want to start with you. Can you start by describing to folks the difference in experience when it comes to Prime Day for those of us who might be purchasing, looking for deals versus folks who are actually working on that day?
So I think for consumers, you know, Prime Day brings with it a lot of excitement because there is this idea that you might get a really great deal on, you know, whatever you're looking to buy. But for the warehouse workers that are employed by Amazon, you know, Prime Day is a very different story. You know, they refer to Prime Day as peak season. That, in addition to the holiday shopping period, are referred to as peak season. And so, you know, for these workers, that means working much, much longer days, rifling through a flurry of orders and just under a lot of immense pressure. And in addition to that, we now know that injury rates spike during peak season or the weeks of Prime Day and Cyber Monday. You know, the Center for Investigative Reporting uncovered this last year when it obtained internal injury logs and found that, you know, during those 2 weeks it had the highest rate of serious injuries for all of 2019. So, you know, while consumers are getting, you know, some great deals during these 2 days, for workers, it's, you know, potentially a much darker outlook.
But Lauren, how is this different than if I'm an accountant and it's tax season, if I'm a political scientist and it's election season? I mean, you know, work is the kind of thing that has these busy periods. Why should we be particularly concerned about what's happening at Amazon, whether it's during the holiday season or the Prime Day season?
Well, for one thing, you know, this is heavy manual labor, right? Unlike a tax accountant, you are bending over thousands of times over the course of, so during most shifts are between 10 and 12 hours in the lead up to Prime Day and Prime Day. So over the course of this many times repeating the same sort of motions, lifting, bending, pulling, repeatedly, that puts a lot of strain on your body, and over time it breaks people's bodies down to the point where they can't work anymore. So I think I would think about it differently than you know, maybe a white collar office job where there's crunch going on. Although maybe there's, I'm sure there's issues with that too. This is really just, you know, serious injuries that, you know, for people's lives, you know, make it difficult for them to walk, to hold other jobs. They have chronic pain for years after they work here. They're not able to work again. So I think it's different in that sense.
And it helped us to also understand this idea of time off task. Again, something that those of us who are in white collar jobs typically don't have to worry about in terms of that surveillance.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's certainly something that a lot of folks have really zeroed in on as being a major issue that's unique to working at an Amazon warehouse, which is these two policies, you know, rate and time off task. And rate is what Amazon uses to monitor the speed with which workers pick, pack, and ship items, while time off task really tracks these workers' movements when they're not at their workstation and not doing, you know, actively working. And so it's part of the way that, you know, Amazon is able to us our packages so quickly is that they keep these workers under a pretty tight working conditions in order to make sure that they are working at a brisk pace. And at the same time, you know, we've got concerns that it adds to this kind of environment of surveillance and tracking, in that, for, you know, a lot of workers have told me that they feel like the time off task policy is what keeps them from feeling comfortable taking an extended bathroom break, or even at, you know, really resting, similar to what Lauren was saying about just how backbreaking this work can be. You know, if you can't really take a moment to sit down or take a break, it can really add stress to these workers' bodies. So their claims are that these policies contribute to that stress immensely.
Now, Lauren, aren't there meant to be federal policies through OSHA that protect workers from this kind of grueling, literally back-breaking labor?
Yeah, so there are, but the penalties for sort of violating, you know, workplace health and safety laws are pretty minimal. And you know, I believe Amazon has been fined before for workplace injuries, like serious ones. You know, the enforcement mechanism, especially during the pandemic when Trump was president, and the agency itself had significantly gotten a lot smaller. So I think that generally you weren't seeing enforcement, and you weren't seeing, you know, companies feeling any real pressure to change some of this stuff. And I guess I'd like just really like to highlight that, yeah, like a lot of this is, you know, directly related to the Amazon, like Amazon's obsession with its customers and customer satisfaction. Like these things are intimately tied, worker injuries and worker, you know, pressure on workers and, you know, what's going on right now.
I know so many of us came to rely on Amazon in ways that we never had previously during the pandemic. I don't know if Lauren or Annie wanted to start first here about how that has impacted what's happening in the warehouses and for the delivery drivers.
Yeah. So, you know, the pandemic has really cemented Amazon's dominance across a number of different categories. It's not just online commerce anymore. I mean, they're in virtually every industry, it feels like, these days. And, you know, that acceleration in online spending has really led more and more people that wouldn't otherwise rely on Amazon for, you know, not just essentials, but a lot of different items around their home. You know, they're now, Amazon is now one of their go-to sites more than before the pandemic. While some industry analysts believe that some folks will probably return to shopping in stores and at some level, you know, for example, there was this huge surge in online grocery spending. You know, some of that is expected to return back to brick and mortar grocery stores. They still believe that it's going to remain at elevated levels. And so for the workers in Amazon's warehouses, you know, I don't believe that it'll be at the same kind of peak levels that they saw during most of 2020. But it does mean that you know, it's much harder for some consumers to kind of understand that when you buy something from Amazon, there is this kind of, I don't want to say not risk necessarily, but there is this consequence, you know, in the background, which is that, yes, you are getting free shipping and it's coming to your doorstep in, you know, 2 days and increasingly now 1 day and same day. There's a worker that at the other end of that is working really hard to ensure that promise. And so I think on Prime Day, you're seeing a lot of different groups trying to highlight that and really make it clear for consumers that, you know, there is a consequence of supporting Amazon.
All right. So if you're a consumer in this moment, do you choose not to support Amazon and in so doing potentially reduce the overall number of jobs that are available? Do you simply not shop on Prime Day because it you know, speeds up that conveyor belt? What are some of the ways that consumers can be more aware of those folks who are working so hard under such difficult circumstances?
Well, I don't think that, you know, we're going to see consumers abandon Amazon at a speed of which we will start to see people's jobs be in jeopardy. I mean, it's important to note that, you know, Amazon is on track to, you know, by 2022 could potentially overtake Walmart as the nation's largest employer. So there is in no way a sign that they're going to slow down anytime soon. But I think for consumers, it's for one thing, putting the onus on consumers is maybe a short-term solution. You know, I think all consumers can benefit from looking at, you know, their spending and saying, you know, maybe I don't need this item in 2 days. Like I could port a store in my neighborhood instead where possible. But I think what's more meaningful in terms of taking Amazon to task around working conditions is really having regulators approach this thoughtfully. And we're seeing a lot of that. And, you know, within the last week, there's been some legislation introduced really aimed at, you know, sizing up big tech companies and potentially even breaking them up. So I think putting the onus on consumers to kind of rein in Amazon isn't necessarily the right solution. But that being said, you know, the more mindful the people can be about where they're, you know, they're spending their dollars online is always, you know, a worthwhile conversation to have.
And Lauren, of course, one of the other ways that we have held companies and employers responsible for workplace conditions over the decades has been labor unions. And Amazon just went through a contentious unionization effort in Bessemer, Alabama that failed. Can you talk a little bit about the possibility of workers themselves organizing on their own behalf?
Yeah, so the union election in Bessemer, Alabama, which was defeated or voted down in March, you know, I think a lot of the labor movement was very disappointed by what happened. But at the same time, you know, the union that organized that warehouse drive, RWDSU, the retailers union, had thousands of workers reach out to them, you know, interested in organizing during that time. You have grassroots sort of organizing drives popping up all over the country right now. There is specifically one at JFK 8 in Staten Island, which is New York City's only fulfillment center. And it's being run by a group of workers, not a, you know, established union. The Teamsters, the biggest logistics union in the U.S., have hinted at a national project toward organizing Amazon and have suggested that they would take a different approach than you know, a traditional NLRB union election. I think a lot of the bigger unions are, you know, looking at what happened in Bessemer and thinking, you know, Amazon really waged a very intense union busting campaign there, where, you know, there are captive audience meetings, mandatory meetings that workers have to attend that are anti-union. They changed street lights, they hired thousands of workers. You know, hard for the union to push back against. So I think a lot of unions are strategizing in terms of, you know, direct actions, strikes, workplace work stoppages, petitions that can sort of build up industry pressure to get Amazon to the bargaining table instead of going the election route. So I think we're going to be seeing a lot more of that.
Speaking of that kind of external pressure, Lauren, there was a letter yesterday from a group of racial justice, labor justice organizations making some demands about Amazon. Can you tell us about those demands?
Yeah, it actually just goes back to what Annie was talking about, time off task. And basically, there is a coalition called the Athena Coalition of around, I think, 36 grassroots organizations in the United States that have banded together to sort of take on Amazon on multiple fronts, you know, antitrust, labor, the environment. And yesterday, they wrote a letter to, I believe, lawmakers demanding that they get Amazon to stop using this time off task policy, which, as Annie explained, you know, pushes workers to not take bathroom breaks, to not have time to rest, to sort of work so hard that they're facing you know, really serious injuries. So that's what that letter was about. You know, I think a lot of the concerns that people have about Amazon are related to the squeeze for productivity as opposed to maybe wages and benefits.
Lauren Corey-Gurley is a senior staff writer at Motherboard, Vice's tech site, and Annie Palmer is a tech reporter for CNBC. Lauren and Annie, thank you both for joining us.
Thanks so much.
Thank you so much, Melissa.
And I also just want to note, we did reach out to Amazon for comment for this story, and we're going to be posting their response on thetakeaway.org. And that's a wrap, y'all. Not to worry, though. We'll be back tomorrow. But in the meantime, if you want more Takeaway, head on over to thetakeaway.org. And before we go, I'd like to give a quick shout out to Jose Olivares. For 3 years, Jose has been part of our producer team and family at The Takeaway, and today is his last day. We just want to say thank you, Jose, for everything. We know you're going on to big and wonderful things, and we wish you all the best. Thanks, as always, to you for listening. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, in for Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.